Welcome to Understory Asia, this 8th day of December. I'm Adrian Glamorgan. Last week, Understory spoke with Jordan Steele John, Senator for the Australian Greens in Western Australia, about AUKUS. We continue this interview today. Jordan Steele John, there's an election next year. Let's say something surprising happens. It seems to be the century of surprises.
It is.
And the Greens are in a minority government. And they make you the foreign minister. What would you do about making peace in our region, making relationships between all countries, including China, and since the United States has a very forward presence in the Western Pacific, the United States as well?
There's a couple of things that I think we could do right now. First of all, we need to close all foreign bases on Australian soil and end the marine rotations through Darwin. We need to do that in conjunction of a renegotiation with the renegotiation of ANZUS and an explicit rejection of the AUKUS pact. Now, doing those things together with a significant reduction in our military expenditure would send a very powerful global message that Australia is an independent nation when it comes to foreign and defence policy, and that we are seeking to reallocate our resources from war to addressing the social, economic and contextual determinants of conflict. So that would be the first thing that you would do. The second thing that you would do, I think, is embark on a process of an authentic process of truth, treaty and reconciliation with First Nations people. And under the framework of that process, both to recognise the sovereignty of First Nations people, and also, I think, inevitably to become a republic in our own right, you further entrench a idea of Australia as an independent nation at peace with itself and its history, acknowledging the wrongs that it has done, redressing them substantively. And part of that redress, of course, is the support of international human rights conventions. And then when it comes to our immediate region, you'd really have to take a two-step process. You'd first have to rebuild relationships with the island nations of the immediate Asia-Pacific region, your Tuvalus, your Fijis, Vanuatus, Nauru, who have experienced us quite legitimately as bullies and as blockers. Bullies in relation to the way that we have treated them, and blockers in relation to one of the main issues that they experience, which is climate change. The Tuvalu foreign minister stood waist high in water to try to bring our attention to climate change only years after we explicitly went to the Pacific Island Nations Forum and blocked commentary on coal. So we've got to rebuild those relationships there and with Indonesia, who rightly, I think, are concerned, as the Malaysians are concerned, with the role, with the potential of AUKUS to escalate tension in the region. And then the second part of that process is, I think, to rebuild your relationship with China based on mutual respect and based on a willingness to own the history and the dimensions of the relationship. The reality is that Australia is incredibly interconnected with China. They are our single largest trading partner. There is a desire on behalf of the Chinese government and the Chinese people to have the successes of the past 20 or 30 years recognised, and particularly in relation to the lifting of so many people out of poverty. So that most certainly needs to be done. And I think we could do a lot by simply having an honest conversation with the government of Japan in relation to their urgent need to do some pretty serious truth and reconciliation in relation to things like Nanjing and the atrocities committed in the Second World War. As part of that process, you then create the space for China to step up and recognise not only what's happening in Xinjiang and in relation to the Uyghur peoples, but also in relation to government surveillance. of their populations and human rights abuses that are being committed. And we would be in a position to play a role in that, being consistent, also calling out Kashmir and Modi and the rest of it, but also balancing that with the knowledge that it actually isn't all about us. And that many of the solutions to these issues will come from Chinese people and people from the Philippines and people from South Korea and people from India. We need to decentralize ourselves from these conversations. Own the fact that many of the problems we either created or played a supporting role in creating, and that as we humbly make ourselves available to be part of the solutions to these problems, we do so without assuming that just because we are Australia, a white nation in the Asia Pacific, that we have access to some magical knowledge that we are wise enough and good enough to gift to a region made up of nations that have existed for 4,000 years. You know, so a bit of humility in our interactions, I think, would go a long way to repairing those relationships.
You mentioned Japan, and it's got a particularly complex relationship in Northeast Asia. How would you build on Australia's current close relationship with Japan?
I think, first of all, if we were in a position to do as the Greens are suggesting, which is to bring our defence expenditure to 1% of GDP, which would constitute a $300 million reallocation over the next 10 years. You actually have the tangible opportunity then, I think, to spark the reverse of an arms race in the region, to spark a demilitarization of the Asia Pacific, particularly of the South China Sea, whether it's Chinese activities in the South China Sea or indeed these so-called freedom of navigation missions that we're also happy to participate in. I think we need to see a demilitarization of the South China Sea. For that particular area of our blue planet to be managed collectively by the nations that border it. And this isn't pie-in-the-sky stuff. If you go back to 2005, 2006, there were tangible proposals being put on the table, I think led by South Korea at the time, to come up with a regional framework for the management of the resources of the South China Sea and of movement throughout the South China Sea. A lot of that has gone in the opposite direction now because of the discovery of gas and significant gas resources in each nation's exclusive area of economic interest, which again brings us back to climate change. But if you demilitarize the Asia Pacific region, South China Sea, then I think it creates the space again for Japan to move back to what had been their post-war role, which was to be a strong ally of the United States, and we can talk about how much choice they're actually given in doing that, but, you know, we're one of the nations with non-aggression embedded in their constitutional framework. So I think that there are conversations that we can have with Japan if, again, and only if, we are able to own the reality of our history, that will enable us to then have those conversations with Japan to enable them to do that work, but also to change the conversation from one where the only way to get on with each other is to have the biggest stick in the room, to actually what are our shared human challenges? How can we work together? How can we embed the relationships between each other? I take an approach to these issues that's very grounded in what is necessary to ameliorate conflict between people. And some people might say, well, Jordan, you can't take that and extrapolate that out to nations. That's naive. I just think it's absurd to think that at some point what works with resolving conflict between one person, two people, a group of people, you know, organizations coming into conflict, stops working because of an imaginary idea of a nation state that we've had for the last 300 years. It's all human relationships. And we can only solve these problems, manage these feelings, which isn't a conversation, it's not a word you often hear in defense and foreign relations. There's all of these complex, grand-sounding names, strategic disposition, strategic weight. It's all feelings. It's all feelings. And to help Japan go on that journey. But again, the role of Australia in that process may actually be rather minimal, and that's okay. We don't have to be the centre of everything all of the time just because we're a white country. Like, that saviour complex that exists in so-called Western nations, that we have access to knowledge that must be what is needed for the world to solve insert problem, is ridiculous and totally at odds with either recent or far gone history. There'll be a role for us, but it might not actually be a big one, and that's okay.
You've got lots of ideas. On the floor of the Senate, there are rules that are stopping the Greens making your presence and position known publicly. But in the corridors and the lunchrooms of Parliament House, how are you able to interact with Labour and Liberal MPs in ways that, being less visible, you can be more candid?
Well, look, I do have conversations with members of all different political dispositions. What I've learned over the last 4 years, and I've recently marked the four-year anniversary of being an MP, is that there is a difference between what somebody might tell you personally and at the end of the day what their party ends up doing or what they end up doing particularly. The difference is community pressure or internal political pressure. My point being that, I mean, I have relationships with lots of different people, some of whom I don't agree with, but ultimately what shifts them is the pressure that they get externally, because the whole institution of the Parliament is designed to make you addicted to it and to want only to stay within it. And therefore, the number one motivating factor is, will this make it more or less likely that I stay there? You know, which is why community organisation is so important. What I would say, and it was fascinating when we were marking the end of the Afghanistan deployment, if it was not for Greens MPs in the Senate and Adam in the House, that debate that occurred over Afghanistan would not have occurred. There would not have been a debate, because Labour and the Liberal Party got up and said the same thing. They said, we must honour our troops and veterans. It was a difficult conflict, but at least we supported the rights of women and girls, as though the rights of women and girls in Afghanistan was a unique concept that we brought to Afghanistan, foreign of anything that existed previously. That although there had been mistakes made, that the motives were good and pure, and that we had at least prevented Afghanistan being a staging post for global terror. Both sides said the same thing, almost word for word. And then it was left to the Greens to actually speak some sort of reality that in relation to our longest war, there were people serving in that conflict whose children and they went, and then the children and grandchildren also deployed to that conflict, and innumerable Afghan lives ruined, and either side could summon was just a rote learned blancmange. So I think that there is a real value in being able to be in those spaces and stretch the conversation into some form of debate. I think that's what we're seeing right now with AUKUS. We've had 15 years of lemming-like commitment on both sides of politics, Labour, Liberal, and the media establishment that overarches them all, that there is only one way to think about China, only one way to think about the United States. There is no alternative view. And the view being advanced is not only the only one, it is the right one. And I think the role the Greens have to play in this space, regardless of the headline, or potentially because of the headline that you get in The Australian as a result, is to challenge that status quo. Because we know that if that status quo goes unchallenged, then the result is conflict, death, war, lost opportunity in critical decades of our time on this earth. Because what is different, I would argue, what must be different in the analysis of these conflicts than potentially any that have come before is that there's a ticking clock in the background, which is the ability of the biosphere to support human life. And if we are spending our time muscling up to China and pointing nuclear-tipped spears at each other, we are losing those precious periods of time to act on climate change. And we have just seen that at COP26. That piddly American-China agreement to vaguely do something that was heralded as a great breakthrough success, if we'd spent the last 20 years building a productive, respectful relationship with China and Russia, if we had properly integrated Russia into Europe at the end of the Cold War rather than ostracizing them, creating the perfect conditions for the creation of an autocrat like Putin, everybody could have been at the table and we could have collectively committed to the actions that were needed to address this problem. We probably would have got there a couple of, maybe even a decade ago. Because we haven't done that, we are now at a situation where we're code red, and the best we could do was kind of keep the opportunity to act alive. We'll come back to it next year, folks. Go home for Christmas. And that's dangerous.
Is there hope?
Yes, yes, there is hope. Let's just take AUKUS that is being presented to the community as a fait accompli. It's done, it's dusted. America, the United Kingdom and Australia have agreed. That's nonsense. That's absolutely nonsense. All they've agreed to is a post-it note that says, you spend the next 18 months trying to figure out how you'll get nuclear capacity and we'll give it to you. That's all they've agreed. So over this next 18-month period, there are wonderful opportunities for the Australian community to rally, to come together, to organise, to speak up in opposition to this proposal, and to the introduction of nuclear technology into our community. And I think we need to be really clear about this. Just because it's in a floating tube off our beaches doesn't actually mean that there is therefore no risk to our community. They've taken nuclear reactors and sticking them off Rockingham Beach, off the ports of South Australia, without any opportunity for the community to have a say there. And I think a lot of Australians will oppose that because we love our coastline and we don't want to see it irradiated. So there are many opportunities, I think, to galvanise that opposition. We also know that the exchange of this technology, because it will be an exchange of nationally held intellectual property, in a sense, will require the implementation of international treaties, which will mean there'll need to be a vote of the US Congress and there'll need to be a vote of the Australian Parliament, meaning this election coming up is an incredibly important opportunity for the Australian community to vote for parties like the Greens that oppose AUKUS and actually will, if that treaty is put before us, vote it down and put a stop to this proposal. So there's that opportunity too. Last thing I'd say is that if you actually look at the surveys of community response in relation to AUKUS, what you see is a remarkable amount of opposition. I mean, this has been sold to the Australian community as the roll, gold, done deal of the century, you know, and, you know, putting aside the fact that the American president couldn't remember our prime minister's name, you know, like there was a lot of fanfare around this announcement. And it, even in that context, about 40% of the community oppose it. So what we have before us now is an opportunity to spend the next 18 months persuading 15% of the population that this is a bad idea, so that when we get to the end of that period and we put the treaty, if the government does put the treaty before the public, before the parliament to proceed with it, that the parliament votes no and sends this idea back into the dustbin of history from which it should never have popped out. So I'm very hopeful that we can do this. And we've seen local AUKUS, anti-AUKUS groups popping up around the country, the formulation soon of a national campaign against AUKUS and against nuclear submarines. So there is so much, I think, hope and energy and a really excellent exchange of knowledge between a generation that took part in the anti-Vietnam protests and the first waves of the peace movement through to the climate strikers and the anti-racism organisers that are beginning to see themselves in each other in whole new, beautiful, radical and deeply energising ways.
I've been speaking with Senator Jordan Steele John about AUKUS, the imperative to prioritise climate action and develop potential peaceful pathways in our region, an alternative to the $300 billion the government plans to spend on arms in the years ahead. You've been with Understory Asia. Thanks for being with us in 2021. My co-presenter and co-producer Elizabeth Poe and I have been the team that's brought you Understory for the last 12 years. Over the summer, do take the opportunity to listen again to past Understories by subscribing on the RTRFM 92.1 website. And as you do, we trust you will have a safe, happy, COVID-free and peaceful Christmas. Let's reconnect in 2022.